are the Burkes of the Department of History at Wayne State University, and I shall be chairing the evening's proceedings. Let me say, first of all, that when I heard that Mr. Jan Novak was going to come to Detroit, I immediately seized upon the occasion as a target of opportunity, hoping and believing that we could persuade him to discuss the dissident movement within Poland that we refer to as Polish Samizdat, a movement which I am sure you understand is more widespread and more daring than its predecessor in the Soviet Union. It sports even a free university, which I understand moves from one hidden location to the next, just ahead of the police. As an old RFE staffer, I envisioned at once the importance of this movement for cross-reporting, which is one of the major functions of both Radio Free Europe in Munich and Radio Liberty. That is to say, what is Polish Samizdat should be reported in our Romanian language broadcasts, in our Czech language broadcasts, and so on, so that in a sense it becomes East European Samizdat. A cross-reporting without which I am convinced such movements might easily wither and die. And I knew that Jan Novak would know more about Polish Samizdat than anyone in the West, and that he would report on it more accurately than anyone else. I knew that from my own experience with him as a colleague in Radio Free Europe. There was a time back in the early 60s when Jan reported that there was within the Polish Communist Party a faction known as the Partisans among the Konoszenti, headed by one Mieczysław Moczar, which aimed to seize power from a failing Gomułka, whose motivation was ultra-nationalistic and whose chief campaign and propaganda was anti-Semitism. With the agreement of his American colleagues, he began to broadcast about the existence of this faction, he and his colleagues, in Polish, to Poland. And very shortly, we began to get some extremely negative noises from the American Embassy in Warsaw via the State Department. Indeed, Jan did not know it at the time. I revealed it to him today. I was called back to Washington, taken into a room in the State Department, confronted by seven Foreign Service officers, and we had a 3.5-hour rundown on the partisan faction. The basic position of the State Department was that it didn't exist, that the embassy knew nothing about it. After it had made inquiry among its regular sources, could find only heated denials that such a faction existed. Therefore, broadcasting about it was counterproductive because it would put the radio in a bad light for having raised a bogeyman, which turned out to be false, and would also unnecessarily destabilize the political situation in Poland. I argued as best I could, stumbling over lists of Polish names and positions which I had memorized, and all I could come away with was some permission occasionally to refer to these individuals, but not in connection with any faction. It was an absolute prohibition. This, I must say, was a rare experience at RFE, but it was an experience. With the passage of time, the embassy did learn that there existed a partisan faction, and that its head was Mieczysław Moczar, that its members and their positions were such as the Polish Broadcasting Department at Radio Free Europe had all along insisted. And gradually this prohibition was released until by 1968, Radio Free Europe was free to broadcast about this as it saw fit. You may remember that the Mocsár faction launched an anti-Semitic campaign in 68 in an effort to magnify its position, but that the events in Czechoslovakia resulted in a Soviet veto on any change in leadership in Poland at that time, and that taken together, I am convinced, with the broadcasts of Mr. Nowak and his colleagues, is what defeated Mocsar's bid for supreme power. Mr. Nowak will talk for about 40 minutes, after which there will be a question and answer period. I only say further, for those of you who are fluent in Polish, that he will give an address tomorrow evening in Polish at 7 p.m. at the Polish National Alliance at Konant and Belmont in this city, that he will discuss his recent book, his memoirs, Couriers of Warszawy, if he will forgive the accent, and will autograph copies for those who are interested. And so, without further ado, I say it is a great privilege and an honor for me to be able to present to you at this time Mr. Jan Nowak. Jan?
Dick, ladies and gentlemen, before I start to talk about dissent in Poland, let me say a few words about the right of dissent in the United States. Because the man who was my teacher and who really showed me what it means is right here. It's Professor Burks, who was associated with me for many years as policy director of Radio Free Europe. I was an exile, stateless, without a country of my own, because I was stateless. I was trying to defend the Polish interests as I saw them. And he was representing the greatest power of the world, the organization that could fire me anytime they wanted. And we had many disagreements. I must tell you that he had a hell of a time with me, that I was an extremely difficult customer, and that not only he, but none of his predecessors or his successors never told me, you obey or else. Never. I never heard of it. In 25 years in Radio Free Europe, there was always an effort to reach a solution through discussion with me as with an equal partner. There was never any kind of pressure. You will lose your job if you don't obey. So that this great lesson of democracy, that an exile, a man without his country, can be treated as an equal partner, as if I would be a representative of some great power, really taught me in my first associations with my American friends what democracy, great democracy, really means. And I am very happy that today, when we have our reunion after many years, I can express my appreciation to Dick Burks and to his colleagues in front of you. And now let me talk about the opposition in Poland. Well, this movement of dissent in Poland had its first birthday at the end of the last year. It was on the 5th of December, 1975, that a Nestor of the Polish scholars, Professor Edward Lipiński, distinguished economist, handed over to the Speaker of the Polish Parliament a memorandum signed by 52 top Polish intellectuals protesting against the proposed amendments to the Polish Constitution, which would make dependence of Poland on the Soviet Union a part of the Polish basic law, and would make it also part of the Polish law, the rule of one party. This protest, or memorandum, was followed by a manifesto of 101 people, and then by another memorandum signed by 95 students from Warsaw, Lublin, and other university centers. These moves were supported by the letter from the Polish Episcopate, who demanded greater freedom for believers. And then you had the avalanche of letters, manifestos, memoranda, signed not only with full first and last name, but also with addresses and even telephone numbers. It is estimated that no less than 40,000 people signed openly these kind of documents. Until now, they were individuals who had courage to come out openly and to say that they disagree with the government and the party, but they were exceptions. Here, for the first time, the barrier of fear was overcome. And you had a manifestation of open thoughts, free thoughts, on a massive scale, without, I believe, any precedent in the Soviet orbit. The second stage came after the riots of the workers in Ursus, a factory near Warsaw, and in Radom, a small industrial center, when the workers protested openly against administrative drastic increase of prices, since they were instantly supported by workers throughout the country who didn't leave their factories. They didn't want to have any confrontation with police on the streets, but simply stayed in their factories and left their tools and were just idle. This kind of general strike throughout the country forced the authorities to withdraw, to cancel the increase of prices within 24 hours. A humiliating defeat, which again, I believe, had no precedent either in Poland or in any other totalitarian state. However, the regime was determined that this kind of things cannot happen again. And they started reprisals against selected individuals. 861 workers were arrested. 386 were tried and sentenced to various terms of imprisonment. About 2,000 lost their jobs. And then the 59 people published, also leading intellectuals, scholars, artists, journalists, published a manifesto setting up an organization called Komitet Obrony Robotników, Committee of Defense of Workers, which was the first open, organized group dedicated to the help, assistance to the families of those in jail and to action which would set them free. Under tremendous pressure and publicity generated by CORE through both at home and abroad, the regime again started a gradual retreat. First, sentences were reduced. Then people with light sentences were released. In January 1977, only 58 people remained in jail. In April, only 20. On 22nd of July, general amnesty was published. And at the end of the year, all were reinstated and all got back into their jobs. Well, the regime thought that as of this moment, the CORE will lose its raison d'être and will cease to exist. But they were wrong. CORE simply changed its name to Committee of Social Defense, retained its initials, CORE, and continued to fight for human rights, for in defense of the rights of individual and the rights of the nation. And then came the third stage, formation of other groups, expansion of the movement in its activities, and its consolidation. In May 1978, Theodor Palimaka, chief of the administrative department of the Central Committee of the Polish Communist Party, was briefing a member of the parties, or rather activists of the party, at a closed meeting. It was a secret meeting, and he offered an assessment of the opposition, which leaked out, indicating that at least one in his audience was a party member who was sympathetic to the movement. Palimaka said that organization structure of the opposition movement expanded considerably and consolidated itself, that it has its own funds, great variety of channel communication with abroad, and that it, he listed the organizations which were already in existence. In addition to CORE, Movement of Defense of Human Rights and Civic Rights, so-called ROPCIO, which was formed in March 1977, Student Solidarity Committees, formed in May 1977 after assassination by political police of Stanisław Pejas, a student in Kraków. The committees were set up in all major university cities. Society of Scientific Course, which sponsors Flying University. The society has a membership of 200 leading Polish scholars. Polish section of Amnesty International and Salon of Independent Thought, a discussion club which held periodical meetings in one of the Warsaw private apartments. The list produced by Palimaka was not complete. He did not mention League for Independence, called PPN, which does not engage in any action, but is devoted to formulation of program and long-range strategic concepts for the Polish nation, its relationship with its ethnic neighbors, its future. It is clandestine. The only group among all of them which is clandestine. We do not know their names. Then free trade unions in Silesia and coastal area. Few small organizations, which, however, it was so difficult to admit their existence by a spokesman of the party that he preferred to leave them out. And finally, peasant self-defense committees, which do exist in several places and are quite active. According to Palimaka, most dangerous are publications. Samizdat. Wide range of publications, information bulletins, political and literary magazines, digests of articles which were suppressed by the censorship, and finally publishing house called Nova, from the words Niezależna Oficyna Wydawnicza, Independent Publishing House. Let me quote him directly. Anti-socialist groups are publicizing their activities by expanding constantly its printing facilities. Its one-time production consists of 19 periodicals and publications and reaches 20,000 copies. Half of it is intercepted by the security police. Since the fall of 1977, the activities of hostile elements amongst academic youth are growing. They take form of expanding territorial range of the Students' Solidarity Committee, large-scale publishing and educational effort, and undertaking anti-socialist ad hoc operations. Particularly dangerous are so-called flying universities, in view of the number of participants and its sponsorship from our academic and technical cadres. Now, this assessment, which appeared in one of the Samizdat publications, was considered as correct by the opposition itself, which took exception only to one sentence, namely that half of the publication is intercepted by political police. They considered it a sort of self-advertising exaggeration. In this past 3 years, pluralist opposition became part of life, well entrenched in the present political reality. And coping with this phenomena, we have to ask several questions. First, how was it born? Was it influenced by the Soviet example of the dissidents in the Soviet Union? Or perhaps it has its own source in local specific conditions in the past and characteristics of Poland. Why was it not eradicated at its inception by political police? Why it has been tolerated so far, not only by the Polish authorities, but by the Soviet Union, which so far didn't even mention its existence? What risks are involved? Is there a danger of the Soviet military intervention? Can it really bring about the same kind of disaster that happened in Czechoslovakia and Hungary? What the opposition achieved so far, and what objectives it expects to achieve in the future? How large it is? What support does it have? What are the prospects for the future? Can the movement survive? And finally, to what extent the dissident movement, not only in Poland, but in the Soviet Union, in Czechoslovakia, has been influenced or can be influenced by outside factors, such as policy of human rights? What the West, and particularly USA, should do in its own interest? Well, let me try to answer these questions as briefly as I can, except the first one, which is perhaps the most complex of all. How the Polish opposition was born? Now, in my view, it is both the product of what happened in the Soviet Union and the outcome of the Polish resistance, which have been lasting without interruption since the communists took over. Of course, when you say the word resistance, you immediately associate it with la résistance, the armed resistance in the last war. But the resistance can have various forms, and it did take various forms in Poland. First, after the war, people were trying to continue clandestine activities, the underground movement, and very soon they discovered that under communist regime it is not possible, that the communist regime has much better ways to infiltrate the groups, infiltrate the society, and therefore all these efforts to continue any kind of underground movement proved counterproductive, because sooner or later it ended in disaster, in public or secret trials, and elimination of the best, most valuable people. Under Stalinist time, in the Stalinist time, between, say, 49 and 54 or 5, this infiltration reached such point of saturation that people were afraid of each other. They suspected an informer of political police in everybody, in a neighbor, in a colleague, even sometimes in a member of family. And this kind of psychological state of mind is something that every authoritarian or despotic regime dreams about, where the people really are so afraid that even most informal links, like friendship between neighbors, between friends, between colleagues, is not possible, because they are afraid of each other. Now, even in this state, when the society was completely atomized, people found very specific forms of resistance. The resistance which was spontaneous, uncoordinated, sometimes subconscious. It was rather a pattern of behavior, a sort of parallel reaction of people living in the same conditions, which did give a very powerful cumulative effect. Let's take as an example peasants. Why it is that collectivization in Poland in the Stalinist time lagged behind the other communist countries, that it couldn't make the same kind of progress? Now, the explanation is pretty simple. Low officials, local officials, who were nearest to the peasants, who were supposed to implement the orders and instructions coming from above, were quietly taking sides of the peasants. Whenever they could do something to protect the peasants without taking too great risks for themselves, they were doing it. And the regime suddenly found that their orders and instructions are simply not implemented, that they have too short arms to reach the peasants. Take workers. Now, the workers at that time, under Stalin, did work under terrific terror. There were terrific penalties for any violation of a discipline in factories. They could go to jail, they could lose their jobs, they lived in fear. But if you use fear as the only incentive, you can extract minimum effort, but you can never force people to give a maximum effort. And the workers used the kind of resistance which is the most dangerous to the communist system. They simply worked slowly and inefficiently. They worked only as much as was absolutely necessary to avoid penalties and to avoid reprisals. And the fact that 6 years plan, which started in 1950, broke down, no doubt, this was the result of the extremely low efficiency of labor, of the fact that workers didn't want to work under this kind of system of incentives. Let's take the intellectuals, the intelligentsia. Now, they depended directly on the state, and they seemed to be the most opportunistic strata of the population. But intelligentsia resisted in the form of so-called internal emigration. Like snails, they withdrew from public life into the four walls of their family homes. They would not read the communist press. They would not listen to the domestic radio. They would not read the books which were written in social realism style. You can compel people to subscribe to Trybuna Ludu, a leading communist paper in Poland, but you cannot force them to read it. And the regime and the intellectuals discovered very soon that they have no market for their products, that they lost touch with the masses, and that this conveyor belt, which was supposed to be a link between them and intelligentsia, does not exist. And frustration of artists or writers, of journalists, who had no market for their products, was one of the sources of a rebellion of intellectuals before 1956. It's the fact that the Polish youth was in the forefront of upheaval of 1956. Let's take the resistance of the church. Now, the church was the only organization allowed to exist other than the Communist Party. But it was in tremendous danger of a split by so-called movement of the patriotic priests, of the priests who were under the pressure of the terror, were intimidated or bribed into disobedience and towards their church authorities in collaboration with the regime. The most formidable obstacle, Cardinal Wyszyński was removed. He was put first in jail and then in isolation. And yet the church preserved both its unity and its independence. Why? Because patriotic priests were ostracized by the faithful, by people, because their churches were empty, because their pockets were empty, and because it simply didn't pay to be a patriotic priest. So, as a result of all this, party itself discovered that the Stalinist system simply doesn't work. And over this issue, there was a split inside the party. How to cope with the problems? You had a liberal wing and you had hardliners who wanted to solve the problem by escalating the terror. I have no doubt that the combination of both, power struggle at the top and discontent of the masses, brought about Polish upheaval of 1956, which brought to power Gomułka and some kind of enforced compromise between people and the regime, some considerable gains, some freedom of margin. Well, then we had a period between 1956 and 1976, or 75, the beginning of the opposition in its present form. It has its ups and downs. You did have Gomułka's policy of gradual retreat from gains of October. You had suppressed riots of students in 1968, students which in their protest were isolated because the rest of people were just watching passively at what happens. You had ups and downs. There was a period, particularly between 1970 and 76, of some passivity, particularly when the regime, there was some kind of mini prosperity in Poland. But the general balance was rather positive. Only in Poland, collectivization did not exist practically. 80% of land remained in the hands of smallholders. The church was not only independent and united, it flourished in spite of all the restrictions. It flourished at the time when in the rest of the world, in the free world, it went through the worst crisis since Reformation. This is the fact which was responsible for the fact that a Pole was elected a pope. Now, only in Poland, the workers became an element of power. They twice brought about a change of ruling group. They twice brought about a change of leadership. And they became an element which the regime has to reckon with. The intelligentsia did retain some margin of freedom of expression which didn't exist in other countries. So, as a whole, Poland became an odd man amongst the other communist countries. Youth was in the forefront of all Polish upheavals in 1956, 68, 70 and 76. Not just students, but also young workers. Conclusion. The present opposition did not emerge suddenly in 1975, just out of nothing. It has its deep roots in the whole post-war period. Even defeat of students in 1968 brought its fruits 10 years later from the generation of students who raised in protest in 68, when they were only not many of them, grew up leaders of the present movements. They grew up and they matured. But you cannot deny also a terrific influence of the Soviet dissidents. The Soviet dissent is older than Polish. The chronicle of current events started to appear in 68. The Polish movement, which took its forms from the Russians, begin 9 years later, or 8 years later. It's very interesting that this long leg of time was necessary for this infection to take effect. But if you look at the forms of the present Polish resistance, they are borrowed from the Soviet dissidents. It's an open movement. It's not clandestine, it's not conspiracy. People come out openly with their own names, even their addresses and telephone numbers. Second, it's a legal movement. They are non-violent. They avoid anything that would violate existing law. They do work and act within the framework of the Polish Constitution and international agreement signed and accepted by the Polish government. They are non-political, and this is typical for the Russian dissent. They unite people around common moral goals. Defense of the human rights, defense of an individual, its dignity, defense of freedom, and defense of law. These are all really characteristics of the Soviet, of the dissident movement in the Soviet Union. And I have no doubt that the pioneers were people like Solzhenitsyn, Sakharov, Paul Litvinov, Grigorenko, and hundreds of others. It is Solzhenitsyn Archipelago of Gulag, which was broadcast to all countries of the Soviet bloc by Western broadcast, by Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, daily, in small installments, that became a gospel of the Polish opposition movement. Solzhenitsyn became the main ideologist. His writings, his ideas, found extremely fertile ground in Poland. The message of Archipelago Gulag is very, very simple. It says that even most despotic, brutal, totalitarian regime must take into account, at least to some degree, the mood, aspiration, attitudes of the population, provided that people have will and courage to manifest their feelings and their discontent. The whole post-war history of Poland provides the clear evidence that Solzhenitsyn was right. Not only by his writings, but by his actions, he, Sakharov, and many others demonstrated that between two extremes, complete surrender of a slave and violence of a rebel, there is plenty of room and chances to protest, to oppose the evil, without resorting to terror and violence. That one can and one should to protest loudly, to tell truth and express openly one's own opinions, thoughts and views, regardless of the consequences. Solzhenitsyn accused his own nation of passivity in face of tyranny. More, even of docile cooperation of victims with its oppressors, with its prosecutors. He claims, and I quote, that if our people would have displayed more civil courage, there would be no need to write this book, because there would be no archipelago Gulag. Now, at first glance, you may say, well, it's far-fetched. It's really going so far that it's like poetic metaphor. But Solzhenitsyn explains that the rule of minority is based exclusively on fear. And that ruling minority becomes helpless when confronted with people who freed themselves from paralyzing impact of fear and are fully prepared for the worst. Only he will win, he writes, who will renounce everything, including life of his own and his beloved. What KGB can do to a man who is no longer afraid of death, of beating, of tortures, of concentration camp, or a jail, or lunatic asylum, if he is not afraid and cannot be intimidated even by threats to his own family? Of course, they can kill him, or they can put him in jail, they can isolate him. But history shows that in certain situations, example of martyrdom can become infectious. And the barrier of fear, once removed on a mass scale, if once it is removed, the instrument of terror becomes blunt. It is no longer effective. Sometimes it becomes counterproductive. If the majority of people are no longer afraid of terror and political police, the situation may be reversed. The ruling elite may become afraid of people and may be compelled to accept compromises, concessions, and in some circumstances, like it happened in Poland, and may even be forced to quit. This movement, said Piotr Grigorenko, helped people to get rid themselves of fear, which paralyzed them in many years. Our moral movement did overcome common lie imposed by authorities. Our movement mobilized self-defense of people, and this is its historical achievement. Now, let's go to the second question, which can be answered much more briefly. Why the regime in Poland did not simply eradicate open opposition at the very beginning? Why didn't arrest people, put them in jail, eliminated them? Now, there are several factors. First, protest action of 1975 took almost immediately a massive proportion. You can arrest an individual. You can arrest even 30, 40, 50 people. But you can't arrest 40,000. You cannot really use this kind of massive reprisals if you face a massive phenomena. And what about the leaders? Now, both in the Soviet Union and in Poland and in Czechoslovakia, the leaders are defended and protected only by publicity, both at home and abroad. This is their only protection. Now, there were other factors. In view of the desperate economic situation, the authorities would depend to a large extent on Western credits and trade and technical knowledge, did not want to ruin their image of being relatively liberal. This is why any publicity in the Western media creates protective shield for the dissident movement. Finally, the regime is aware that reprisals on larger scale would alienate totally, at least intelligentsia, and possibly lead to conflict with the church. I personally do not believe that the workers would rise in defense of intellectuals. It never happened in history, and I believe that... sort of economic bad conditions would really push the workers again to the streets, or even to some kind of a strike. Now, is there a risk of Soviet intervention? Definitely, yes. Such risk always exists, but should be appraised realistically. There is no analogy between today Poland of 1979, Hungary of 1956, and Czechoslovakia of 68. Why? For the first time, against invasion in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia was against the leadership. And the objective was to replace the leadership which was no longer loyal, the leadership which was taking side of the revolting people, rather, and which renounced its ties with Moscow, if not totally, at least partially. In Poland, the leadership, present leadership, is absolutely loyal to Moscow. It does try to contain the opposition. It never takes its side. Therefore, there is absolutely no reason why the Soviets should really invade Poland, because they have no motive to replace the present leadership. Two, in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia, Soviet troops met with no violent resistance. There was an outbreak of violence against the local regime, but Soviet tanks were not opposed. In Poland, they cannot be sure. This is such an unpredictable nation, which already once sacrificed its own capital, that they really don't know. And the spectacle of the Soviet troops, of the Soviet tanks crushing Polish working class, would have such adverse effect on the Third World. It would make their strategy of conquest without war so difficult, they would have to pay such a high price for it in political terms, that they consider this kind of situation as the last really resort, something that would really they would resort only when it would be absolutely necessary to maintain the regime, the system. Then you have to take into account that the opposition in Poland takes much more realistic position than Hungarians or Czechoslovaks. They do understand that they cannot overstep the boundary, and the demarcation line is clear. One, the dependence on the Soviet Union, membership of the Warsaw Pact, and second, one party rule. This cannot be changed, but it can be interpreted in various ways. The interpretation is flexible, and depending on the situation, it can be interpreted in a more liberal way, so that within this borders, within this lines of demarcation, there is still room for some partial liberalization, for some improvement of the situation. And this is what they fight for. They do not fight for introducing in Poland a parliamentarian democracy. They know very well this is not possible under present situation. Finally, one can say that three elements, Moscow, Polish communist regime, and the opposition have one common interest, not to allow the explosion and violent confrontation. Opposition knows that it would mean the end of their activities. Leadership knows that they would lose power and be replaced by other team, and Moscow knows that it would be too expensive. The danger of Soviet military action would become imminent in two cases. One, disintegration of the regime. In case the regime is losing control of the situation, we would have to face the imminent threat of Soviet invasion. And the second, general explosion, which would spread to the whole country and which the regime would not be able to prevent or to contain with its own forces. But you may also take into account one possibility. that if such danger does exist, the opposition may try to help the regime to calm down people. It happened already once, when in 1956, two leading communists went to Comanche, when Cardinal Wyszyński was isolated and kept under guard, and persuaded him to come to Warsaw and try to help them to calm down people. And he did, without any condition, because he felt this was in the Polish interest. Today, the same situation may repeat itself. Who knows, maybe such leaders of the opposition as Kuroń or Michnik or any other, who have tremendous authority because of their courage and their resistance, may one day say, people, be calm. Don't go to the streets, because it may ruin everything, and they will maybe listen in too. Well, next question. What risks other than the Soviet interventions are involved? Now, I think that economic and political situation enforced certain restraint and tolerance. But it is impossible to tolerate certain pluralism outside the party and to maintain monolithic unity within the party. Once you have pluralism in among the people, you cannot really prevent factionalism inside the party. And there is always a danger that this faction Dick was talking about, the faction of political police and hardliners may take advantage of the situation and try to take over power. Now let's ask, how strong is the movement? I mentioned at the beginning it was estimated that 40,000 people signed all kinds of petitions. Maybe they are twice as much. But Poland has 36 million people at the moment, and you have to admit that it is a minority, and a small minority. But if you count only people who are acting openly, it's a minority. But if you take into account that in 1 year only, CORE, one of the groups, collected more than 2 million zlotys, and they were mostly small silver collections, you can see how large is the support of people who do not come out into the open, but that do offer some kind of assistance, of help, if only moral. I was present in the Congress when Mrs. Solzhenitsyn was answering the questions of the Helsinki Committee. And she was asked with some skepticism, well, how strong are you? How many of you there are? And she said, I caution you, don't count us by number of heads. If you count people like my husband, there are not many, not even 1,000. But if you include people who are trying to help us, and some of them who couldn't help us, but shook our hands just to let us know that they are with us, then you would have much more than 1,000, many thousands. And if you include a wife of a party dignitary who secretly at night brings her child to be baptized in the Orthodox Church, then you have to add so many people. And then if you include a teacher who, instead of reading to his students Sholokhov, reads to them Pushkin, then you will have millions of people. And this is so. After all, Christian Church developed from a small sect. This was just a handful of people. And they, after several centuries, conquered the world. So there is something in this objections which were now repeated by Ginsburg. Don't count, because in no country you can find heroes, martyrs, who will be a majority. The majority will join them when they see the opportunity, when the hopes becomes realistic, when the better future is within sight. Now, what is the future? Excuse me, I will finish in a minute. What is the future? I think any prophecies are, of course, futile. But you have to say that all depends on what happens in Moscow after the departure of Brezhnev. And you can develop two scenarios, one optimistic, one pessimistic. Naturally, they're extremes. Let me start with a optimistic scenario. Following Brezhnev's departure, there is a transition period and protracted power struggle. Successor does not have the same kind of power as his predecessor. Factions involved attempt to find allies outside their own narrow circle. Each tries to win their own allies outside the circles. First, the army or KGB or some elements in both, then party intellectuals and activists, then the students, and finally broad masses. This was the exact pattern of development in Poland, Hungary and Czechoslovakia. If this process can last long enough to gain momentum and activate the masses and generate some centrifugal tendencies, then the opposition, not only in Poland, but everywhere, will have its own great opportunities. Naturally, you can also think about pessimistic scenario. Succession is resolved in a matter of days, or maybe hours, by some kind of a coup within small circle, by some kind of alliance between the army and KGB. The leadership, new leadership, takes form of some kind of Bonapartism. It tries to take advantage of its armed superiority or equality with the West. Moscow, faced with growing international tension, will take some security measures. And then the opposition, both in the Soviet Union, in Poland and elsewhere, may be wiped out with just one big stroke. But between these two oversimplified extremes, there is the whole variety of unpredictable possibilities which we do not know now. All we know is that the opposition movement that lasts so long, in spite of tremendous efforts to intimidate, to discourage, of risks involved, is something that acquired the characteristics of a permanent element of reality. Let me finish here, and I will be glad to answer your questions and maybe to touch upon the last point, which is the problem of what the West should do or what it shouldn't do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jan. I think it would be appropriate for me to say at this time that I have been told, I was not present in Munich in 1956, that one reason the tragedy of Budapest was not repeated in Warsaw is that Jan Novak and his colleagues hung on that horn up to 23 hours in every 24 hours. And said, don't you do it. This is not the time. Hold on. It would be a great tragedy. Now, having said that, let me ask for the first question. Professor Brazel.
Mr. Novak, I think at the very end, you indicated the question that is impressing all of us, that is, what is it that the West should do under the circumstances that you described? What's a reasonable policy for the United States to follow or the West in general to follow?
I believe that as long as there is a commitment of expansion built in the Soviet doctrine, it is in the vital interest of the free world that the process of peaceful change, non-violent change, should be supported. Because only in this way, by erosion of this commitment, the United States can achieve stability. People who believe that support for dissident group would be destabilizing and who believed that stability should be achieved by complete non-interference are wrong in my view, because I believe that the main destabilizing element is the Soviet policy. A Soviet policy of expanding at the expense of the West, of taking of one strategic advantage after the other, of constant expansion. How the West can help? I don't believe by inciting people or by giving them any kind of advice or by any kind of agitation that the Soviets were, for instance, conducting in Iran through their radio. But I believe that the most important instrument is a free flow of information and ideas. I believe that the radios are the only, probably, leverage that the West does have. Western radio, and in this arsenal, two radios, Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, takes 80%. Mrs. Solzhenitsyn was asked, how the Soviets can eliminate you? Can they eliminate you by arrests or by expelling all of you? And she said, no, because there will be others who will take our place. He thought for a minute and said, well, if we would have no Western broadcast, there would be no point in continuing, because we would lose our communication with the masses and we would lose any chance of having a conveyor belt with the other countries. We would have been completely isolated. Unfortunately, this instrument, in time when it is so needed, is being gradually dismantled by repeated financial cuts. It's very inexpensive if you consider that the future of the free world may be decided not on the battlefield. I don't believe myself in a possibility of nuclear holocaust. It's so dangerous for both sides that it seems to me unlikely. But it can be decided in the human minds. This is the battle of ideas, basically. And I believe that transmitters may be more important than missiles, ballistic missiles. So that I believe that, in the first place, the mass communication media, which help to keep the societies open, which give them some kind of option in formulating their own judgment, which help them to become free in their own mind, is an instrument of greatest strategic importance. Second, policy of human rights. It boosted the morale of dissident movements considerably. But I believe that in its implementation, it became ineffective. Why? Because the slogan itself was excellent. The principle, moral principle of restoring moral element into the American policy was, in my view, right and worthy of every support. But the very fact that implementation was left exclusively in the hands of administration, of the State Department, of the office of Mrs. Derian, was wrong, because the arsenal at the disposal of the diplomacy is very limited. It's limited only to the negative measures, like refusal of economic aid, refusal of military aid, diplomatic protests, which can be applied only to one own client. You don't help Soviet Union militarily. You don't offer even any kind of economic aid. Maybe Poland is the exception. So the negative measures are one-sided. They can be applied only in one direction, against right-wing dictatorship. Policy of human rights has to be non-ideological. It has to apply universally in the whole world. And this you can achieve only if you involve people themselves. If you create a body independent of the government, or even autonomous, which would be supported by the Congress, but would become a symbol and could apply positive measures, like rewards, awards to people who are particularly courageous, the artists, to dissident artists or writers who are not published in their own countries, to publication in the native languages of the literature banned by the local regimes, by supporting also, by in a way of prizes and rewards, of organizations in this country who are dedicated to the defense of human rights. This is not being implemented. The Institute of Human Rights, which was proposed by Fassel and Fraser and Pell, was rejected at the request of two ultra-conservative congressmen on the plenum of the House. $1 million was involved only. And they said, this is interference in other countries' affairs. It's a repetition of what CIA was doing, and it's a waste of money. And next to me was sitting Mr. Andrei Suvorov, press attaché of the Soviet embassy, who embraced his comrades, and I don't know his name, and they shook their hands. They were delighted. You see, so I believe that proper policy of human rights, which should be conducted by the American people in cooperation with their government and with the support of their government, could create a symbol, a continuity, make policy bipartisan, non-ideological, and universal. I think this is what could it should be done. It should be limited to only non-violent moral resistance, never to any violent groups fighting with terrorism, with terror. In my view, this would be probably the most proper thing for the West, and particularly the United States, to do. Amnesty International, let's follow it with Democracy International.
Professor Zeger, had his hand up first, and then you next. Professor Zeger, please. Would you all stand, please, so that we can all be sure to hear the question?
I'm Robert Zeger, in the History Department of Wayne State. You touched upon the economic aspect.
Yes.
I wonder if you might expand on that a little bit. There has been a good deal of criticism recently of what kind of policy the most dangerous.
It is a complex problem. In my view, one should differentiate between policy to the Soviet Union and to the satellite nations. I don't believe that the export of technology and capital to the Soviet Union is really in the American interest. I believe as long as they are involved in this kind of military build-up, this kind of policy, any help in exporting know-how and any credits make it easier for them to expand militarily. So I think that this policy, as far as the Soviet Union is concerned, is counterproductive. This is my view. However, I do support the policy of assistance, limited assistance, to the satellite nations. Why? Because I'm sure that one of the reasons why dissident movement exists in Poland is that the regime is anxious to get credits, since any revolution or any upheavals in these countries is really completely counterproductive. As long as Moscow can really invade and eliminate it, I think that in such situation as Czechoslovakia or Poland or Hungary, limited policy of credits, trade preferences and all this do help the process of changes. Polish situation is absolutely desperate economically. This is one of the reasons why they really are afraid to move, to do something against the dissident movement. I believe if tomorrow the Congress would say no more one penny to Poland, and the France and West Germany, who are playing much bigger role now than the United States, would do the same, the whole opposition movement would be wiped out. I'm not sure if this is valid as far as Soviet Union is concerned.
A gentleman at the end of this row, would you stand, please? And if you like, we'd be glad to have your name.
I'm Ben Markowski. My question concerns the arts in Poland, which I find...
Concerns?
The arts.
Yes.
Could you speak a little louder, sir, please?
My concern is the unusual... avant-garde movement in the arts, which is very creative and very refreshing and stimulating.
Yes.
And it's a unique phenomenon, not only, I would say, for the satellite nations, but I think the form of expression in all of the fine arts is so advanced, even for the Western countries.
Yes.
How do you explain that?
I believe that in the regime view, the art is the opposition in art, in the form of avant-garde, is the most harmless form of expression, that it would be much more harmful to them to interfere rather than to ignore it. The only thing they do, they don't buy. The state is not a customer. The state does not buy this art, but there is sufficient market among the Polish people and enough freedom to export some of this abroad to keep it alive. As I said, the Polish regime does not tolerate this kind of deviations because it is liberal, but because it's pragmatic. It simply thinks that it doesn't pay under these circumstances, faced with this kind of resistance and solidarity of people, to fight. This is my view. Simply, they are choosing lesser evil. They believe it's much better to close eyes and tolerate it than to start to confiscate the pictures, which are displayed, as you know, sometime on the streets or in the private apartments. They are not allowed into official galleries, mostly. Excuse me.
I'm not talking just about the paintings and so forth, but, for instance, you have the Autumn Festival, Warsaw Autumn Festival of Contemporary Music, which is held every September, and it's been going on for 25 years. And here you have a very public forum supported by the state for expression in one
yes.
form of art. I'm sure that all the galleries do have exhibits of all of the current artists, and I'm sure that they're all represented in galleries. The scenography, in film, even in literature, there is no end to it. It is obviously depicted, published.
I agree entirely with
very,
you.
Very wide.
I entirely agree with you. My only answer is a relative weakness of the regime, a relative strength and power of the intellectuals. If they would, they would be divided. If they would start to fight each other. If there would be many prepared to really implement party line, you wouldn't see it. But they are really no, the censorship is purely negative. They cannot compel people to follow the party line in art or in literature or in any kind of creative activities. All they can do is to be negative, not to suppress. But they believe that the spoken word or written word is dangerous. It's a carrier of idea. But they believe that the music is not dangerous. It's or least dangerous. It does attract a lot of currency because, as you know, the Warsaw Autumn brings plenty of people from abroad. And therefore, they feel that are too weak, really, to even try to impose on the artists any kind of party line, any kind of social realism. Social realism was completely unsuccessful. It ended in complete failure, and they know that they cannot undertake this effort again. This is all I can answer.
Ms. Danuta Bochar, please.
I was just going to comment on this particular
yes.
question.
Could you raise your voice a bit so we all can hear?
The question of why the arts are so avant-garde in a planned or a constructed, relatively restricted structure. I spent some time in Poland and I asked people about this particular phenomenon, and the point you just brought up about the economic purpose mm-hmm. or economic advantage of having such avant-garde art is, of course, very important. Also, the point was brought out to me that it looks good. It promotes mm-hmm. a good image. We have Polish filmmakers winning Cannes Award Festival. Polish artists exhibited around the world. Polish musicians likewise. Penderecki, for example, one of the most avant-garde musicians. All of this promotes a very good image in the press, things of this sort. And also, as one filmmaker, Zanussi, was
yes.
quoted in an interview in Washington, he was asked about censorship and the restrictions about these types of films. He made the point that nothing in my films is put there that I do not approve of. Certain things are eliminated, he said, but nothing is put there that
exactly.
I personally do not approve of.
Exactly.
The lady in the third row here, please.
My name is Troy Evans. I know how many of us here were in Warsaw, Poland in 1956 in October. I was there. I was still there in Poland, working and living in Poland, and I took a part in that mass meeting at Palace Kultury and Palace von Sokol Wolności with 300,000 people massed together on Marszałkowska Jerozolimskie around the Palace Kultury, and we stood there. We stood there for 3 hours, mute. We didn't talk except exchanging some remarks between us. It was a mute demonstration, and it was quiet. We knew that all around Warsaw they had been Russian tanks group. They had been not on the border, they had been not in Brodnica Śląsk. They had been right there, and we have been, as I say, 300,000 people mass, and we have been stunned. Not by what happened around us, we have been stunned by our attitude that we didn't do anything but spark that, you know, that made a spark to start something really green. That was after Budapest, that was after, and right there, and later, several days or maybe several weeks later, we analyzed our behavior. And we all came to one contention, that Polish society mature, that is not the same. We have been still the same generation, now it's a new generation maybe taking over, but that was the same generation which matured in 1939, matured during the war, and matured through Warsaw Uprising, and later concentration camp, and other suppressing periods, say, Poland between 1945 and 56. And sure, individual like Cardinal Wyszyński, who got tremendous authority in Polish, and still has in Polish society, Radio Free Europe, but they have been individuals. We have been that mature, much more mature, as I say, society than it was in 1939. And that was our gain. I remember we have been talking and we have been exchanging that we are not going anymore for bloodshed of 1939 when against tanks have been going horses or people on foot. We are not going to do a second Warsaw Uprising from 1944 because we cannot afford. We know how much it costs. So this I would like to underscore that Polish society is maturing, and I am sure that during those 20 years when I am not there, they mature a lot more, and now we can work with them completely on a completely different level, not emotional, but an intellectual and really diplomatic.
Mr. Oliarczyk, and then you, sir.
Coming back to this country and the attitude, the very same time that the first protest of the intellectuals was taking place in Warsaw in 1975, there was a briefing being held by Mr. Helmut Sonnenfeld to our ambassadors in Eastern Europe, trying to convince them to that they should do everything to tie the countries to the Soviet Union, never encourage any kind of leaning towards the West. And how do you assess, is this still a very strong faction within the State Department or within the political circles in this country?
Well, I think that we are a pluralistic society here, and there are all kinds of elements. There are people who believe that United States should keep off its hands, it should be completely neutral, that it has some interest in so-called stability, which I believe is completely wrong notion. But you cannot say, really, that the present administration is taking this attitude. Let me tell you that Ambassador Schäuble, who was appointed last year, was the first American ambassador who paid official visit to Cardinal Wyszyński. It never happened before. He was the first ambassador who went to the meeting of journalists and spoke in, I would say, undiplomatic terms. He was simply talking frankly to a large meeting of people. President Carter, when he was in Warsaw, probably under influence of one of his or some of his advisors, went out of his way to underline that he is not only visiting the officials, but he is trying to also to pay a visit to a nation. After all, he went and put his wreath before the monument of the Polish insurgents of 1944. No other head of state did this before. He made several gestures, even the way he something he inscribed when he was putting wreath on the tomb of unknown soldiers. He did answer the opposition when they didn't let them join the press conference. He did answer their questions. So I believe that there is an effort to maintain double dialogue, one dialogue with the regime on this level and the other with the people. Unfortunately, because of the economic situation in this country, because of the internal situation in this country, there are such problems as decline of radios, which in my view are playing absolutely strategic and crucial role. I don't believe it's a policy. I don't believe that this is a Sonnenfeld doctrine. I think simply that this is a lack of understanding amongst the public about the nature of the present confrontation between West and East. I think myself that somebody said quite rightly that nuclear power in our age become another Maginot line. It really absorbs people so much that they forget that we are facing conquest without nuclear power, by proxy, by all kind of ways and means, without resorting to general confrontation. And that the most important thing is to try to influence the process of peaceful change within the Soviet bloc, and that such change is a realistic possibility. Although it may look like something very small, very weak, you never really know how fast it can suddenly develop when the circumstances change.
I had a question here. My name is Mr. Benjetsky. I have a question. What is your view about the visit of foreigners in Poland and other satellites? Is that helpful in any dissident movement, and to what extension is it helpful?
To what extent? Well, I believe myself that anything that helps to open the door is useful. I think that the very fact that Polish community in the free world from the beginning was trying to maintain ties with their relatives and friends in Poland was of tremendous importance. Even these parcels that were sent in millions from London, from Detroit, from Chicago, in the Stalinist time, they have a tremendous moral value, in my view. And the visits, well, of course, it's a complex problem, but the contacts with the West, by people coming here and by people going there, does help to keep the door open. It's, of course, up to the people if they try to exploit these opportunities in the right way. But in my view, if we want Poland to remain, if not a open society, then at least to prevent this from being a closed society, we should support cultural exchanges, and we should support the free traffic of people, or even fight for it. We cannot fight for Barańczak, or who is invited to Harvard and offered the professorship, if we at the same time would try to prevent people from going to Poland. So I think it is a complex thing, because I am aware of the fact that UB, political police, is trying to take advantage of these visits very often, that the people are very often intimidated, that there are attempts to recruit them, and all this. But in spite of this, I believe that anything that helps to keep the door open is very important and useful.
I have a question here. My name is Jakub Kaminski. I have a simple question. What, in your opinion, has to be done to change the financial trend of rent-free Europe?
Well, I think one should simply make the American Congress and the people at large more aware of its importance, more aware of its role, and also of its plight. This is the main question. And it's easy. If you people like yourself, will really organize themselves and create a lobby. I'm sorry, I'm talking frankly. Very good, then start, please. You know, I frankly live in Washington. I don't see, I travel all around the world. There are plenty of patriotic Poles everywhere. If they would like really to undertake the work of telling people what it means to them, not to Poland, but to the American interests, if they would like to influence their congressmen, their senators, if they would know how to organize themselves, then I am quite sure that even ethnic groups in this country, organizations such as All Churches, the Jewish groups, they do have their vested interests in Radio Svoboda because they have plenty of Jews in the Soviet Union they want to get out of there. Then I'm sure that this instrument would get all the means which are necessary to make it effective.
Mr. Leone, please.
Right. I have an even simpler question. If I visited Poland and took along with me certain proscribed writings or books and distributed them, not let's say out in the plaza or someplace, but left them with students, they'd probably be in English, but they're translated books. Would I be searched going in where they would be found? And if they were found, what would happen to me when I was there?
Well, in the first place, since you are an American, it's very unlikely that you would be searched in the first place. Very unlikely. If you are searched, it would be confiscated, period. Your risks are nothing comparing with the risks of people who write samizdat inside Poland. Then they will be fired from their job, they will be arrested for 48 hours and then released and then rearrested again. They will lose their chance to go to travel abroad. They will lose their right to publish, open the books and all this. So your risks are nothing in comparing with other people's risks. And if worse happens, you'll be thrown out of the country. That's all. This is all you risk. Compare it with the kind of risk that people like Ginsburg was taking, the man who went to the camp and suffered the things he did. They're nothing.
Have one more question. Mr. John Bonnick.
Yes, if you assume that Soviet aims in the long run are antithetical to U.S. aims,